Hey, future doctors. Thanks for tuning in to Spoonful of Sugar, a podcast made for medical students by medical students to help the medicine go down. My name is Ghazal Adibi, and I'm a medical student at Ohio University's Cleveland campus, and I will be your host today. Let's picture this. You're seeing a 7-year-old who can't sit still in class, is constantly interrupting others, and forgets their homework. The teacher says that they're very bright, but just can't get them to focus. What does this make you think of? If you said ADHD or attention deficit hyperactivity disorder, then you're right on track for today's episode. I'm going to start us off with a quick overview of diagnosis and neurobiology, then spend most of our time diving into the high-yield pharmacology, so going over mechanism and side effects. I personally found ADHD to be one of the more high-yield psychiatric diagnoses tested on both Step 1 and Level 1, so I'm going to do my best to go over what's often tested on these exams. And remember, this is just a review episode. Don't worry if you don't know something. Making mistakes is the best way to learn it. I'll be keeping this super question and answer style, so there's going to be plenty of opportunity to really quiz yourself. And if I'm going too fast at all, feel free to pause and give yourself some more time to think. And with that, let's get into it. So starting off really broad, do you guys know the three main symptom clusters of ADHD that you should be able to recognize on your boards? That's right, it would be inattention, hyperactivity, and impulsivity. For diagnosis, you need at least 6 of these symptoms from either the inattention or the hyperactivity impulsivity cluster, and it should be going on for at least 6 months. Also, keep in mind the onset of age is before 12 years old. I don't think the minutia of this is that high yield, and it's definitely a little bit more nuanced in actual clinical practice, but definitely still worthwhile to know. When diagnosing ADHD, in how many settings must these symptoms be present? So that will be in 2 or more settings. Think along the lines of having these symptoms both at home and at school. Also, important to keep in mind that there's no intellectual disability with ADHD. So if you're seeing that in your question stem, you might want to think of other differentials or maybe another comorbid diagnosis. All right, now let's get a little bit into the neurobiology. I think this is really important because it sets up everything we need to know about the pharmacology. So do you know the 2 key neurotransmitters involved in ADHD pathophysiology? If you said dopamine and norepinephrine, great job, that's correct. So specifically, there's decreased activity in our prefrontal cortex involving both of these neurotransmitters. That's why a lot of the medications target these exact systems. Do you know what brain region is most associated with executive function and attention? I kind of just mentioned it already. Great job. That would be our prefrontal cortex. This is exactly where we're seeing the dysfunction in ADHD. Think of it as the brain's CEO, and it's not getting enough neurotransmitter signals in order to do its job properly. This is where we see what we call that executive dysfunction. Do you know which neurotransmitter pathway is most associated with reward system and motivation? Great job, that would be dopamine, particularly in the mesocortical pathway from the ventral tegmental area to the prefrontal cortex. When this is underactive, you get a lot of problems with motivation and sustained attention, which is what we see oftentimes in ADHD. Okay, now we can really get into the pharmacology. I think this is probably the most high-yield portion of today's episode. Do you guys know the first-line treatment for ADHD? Great job. This is going to be stimulants alongside with behavioral therapy. Can you name the 2 main categories of stimulants that are used for ADHD? Great job. This is amphetamines and methylphenidate. So let me kind of give you a breakdown of the specific drugs you should know. So for the amphetamines, this includes dextroamphetamine, mixed amphetamine salts, so that's Adderall, and then lisdexamfetamine, which is Vyvanse. For the methylphenidate, there's immediate release, which is Ritalin, and extended release, which is Concerta. Don't worry about knowing all those names, but these drugs are pretty common in clinical practice, so if you hear that thrown around, you'll have a better idea of what's going on. Here's where it gets really testable. Do you know the mechanism of action for amphetamines? So they actually work through three mechanisms. The first one is blocking reuptake of dopamine and norepinephrine. The second one is promoting release of dopamine and norepinephrine from their presynaptic terminals. And the last one is inhibiting MAO, so monoamine oxidase. Now, what about methylphenidate's mechanism? Do you know that one? Great job. So methylphenidate primarily blocks reuptake of dopamine and norepinephrine, similar to amphetamines, but it's less involved in promoting the release and it's not involved at all in MAO. So that's our stimulant medications. What about some non-stimulant treatment options? Do you guys know those? So this would be atomoxetine, which is Strattera, as well as guanfacine and clonidine. I'm going to focus more on atomoxetine. I found that to be a little bit more commonly tested in terms of ADHD. So do you know atomoxetine's mechanism of action? Great job. It's a selective norepinephrine reuptake inhibitor. I always thought of it as basically an antidepressant, but specifically for norepinephrine. Kind of helps me visualize the mechanism a little better. What is a major advantage of taking atomoxetine or other non-stimulants over a stimulant medication? If you said no abuse potential, that is correct. So the stimulants are controlled substances, so they have a high abuse potential, whereas the non-stimulants don't. Do you guys know the black box warning for atomoxetine? Great job if you knew that. So it's actually suicidal ideation, especially in children and adolescents. This is the same warning we see with many antidepressants. So if you can kind of group those together in your head, it'll be a little easier to remember. Okay, now let's talk about the side effects. This is also definitely heavily tested. So here's a classic board scenario. You have a 10-year-old taking methylphenidate for 18 months, and he's coming in for follow-up. The growth chart shows he's dropped from the 75th percentile to the 25th percentile for both his height and weight. What is the most likely cause here? If you said growth suppression, that's correct. This is probably the highest yield stimulant side effect for boards. And do you know the mechanism behind this growth suppression? Great job. So it's actually appetite suppression, which leads to a decreased caloric intake and then subsequent growth delays. Do you guys know the typical management for stimulant-related growth suppression? So this is when we would do what's called drug holidays. So usually during summer breaks or a time when academic performance isn't as critical, the patient is asked to stop taking the medication. This isn't really high yield in terms of testing, but in case you ever hear the word drug holiday, now you know what that means. So here's another scenario. You have a teenager with ADHD who starts stimulants and then develops new onset repetitive eye blinking and throat clearing. Do you know what's going on here? So this is tic emergence or exacerbation. An important thing to keep in mind is that stimulants aren't causing these tics de novo. It's more so that they can mask an underlying tic disorder or worsen an existing one. Speaking of side effects, cardiovascular effects are also really heavily tested. On that note, what's two really important vital signs you should always check before starting a stimulant? Great job. So that would be blood pressure and heart rate. Since stimulants have sympathomimetic effects, they increase both of these. And for example, uncontrolled hypertension would be a contraindication to stimulant use. Okay, now what about sleep? Do you guys know the effects of stimulants on sleep? Yep, nice job. This one's pretty intuitive. So stimulants commonly cause insomnia, especially if you're taking them later in the day. If you can remember that stimulants just tend to really amp things up, like kind of having a cup of coffee or maybe too many cups of coffee, you can kind of reason out the side effects there. Can you think of some things that might be absolute contraindications to stimulant use? I know we already mentioned one of them. Great job. So we're thinking uncontrolled hypertension, as we mentioned, a recent MI or arrhythmia, hyperthyroidism. Another one could be MAO inhibitor use. Since we talked about how amphetamines also inhibit MAO, you wouldn't want to take two drugs that are doing that. All right, lastly, I'm going to throw you a bit of a trick question, but do you guys know if stimulants lower seizure threshold? So traditionally, it's taught as yes, and package inserts tend to still warn about this, but looks like large population studies actually suggest that stimulants are pretty safe and might even reduce seizure frequency. I don't really want to confuse you guys with this minutia, but I think the boards might not be up to date with this information. I had one question on my level one question bank that tested stimulant side effects, and seizures was the correct answer. It's definitely pretty nuanced and low yield, but just wanted to throw it out there in case you ever see it. All right, let's wrap up with some rapid fire review. What's the first line ADHD treatment? Great job. It's stimulants and behavioral therapy. Now, what are two main stimulant categories? Awesome job. So that is our amphetamines and methylphenidate. Starting off with amphetamines, what is its mechanism of action? So three things to keep in mind here: blocking reuptake, promoting release, and inhibiting MAO. Now, how about the methylphenidates? What's the mechanism of action there? Nice job. So it's primarily blocking our reuptake. What is a non-stimulant medication with no abuse potential? Great job. So the highest yield one here would be atomoxetine. And do you know atomoxetine's mechanism of action? That's right. It's a selective norepinephrine reuptake inhibitor. And then lastly, what is atomoxetine's black box warning? That would be suicidal ideation. All right, if you made it to the end of today's episode, go ahead and give yourself a big pat on the back. I know these topics can seem pretty nuanced, but the boards tend to test as pretty straightforward. So if you can get a good grip of the pharmacology and the basic diagnostic criteria, I know you'll be in good shape. So remember the key points. Stimulants are first line. They work on dopamine and norepinephrine systems. And watch out for growth suppression, cardiovascular effects, and abuse potential. Atomoxetine is your go-to non-stimulant, and it's got no abuse potential. Thank you so much for listening. If you found this episode helpful, please subscribe to our podcast. If you have any questions, comments, or concerns, visit our website at spoonfulofsugar.org and post them under the link for this episode. I'm wishing you the best of luck with studying, and remember that if you ever have an SOS moment while studying, Spoonful of Sugar is always here to help the medicine go down.